The following recording was produced by Christ Redeemer Church of Hanover, New Hampshire. The speaker is Doug Cooper. You may find more information on the church and its various resources on the web at www.christredeemerchurch.org.
Okay, I'm going to start at Mark 14, verse 32, and read to the end of the chapter. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and they began to be deeply distressed, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak." Once more he went away and prayed the same thing. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy and they did not know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and he kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Am I leading a rebellion," said Jesus, "that you have come with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me, but the scriptures must be fulfilled." Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. They then took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death, but they could not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony about him. "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this man-made temple, and in 3 days will build another, not made by man.' Yet even then their testimonies did not agree." Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." The high priest tore his clothes. "Why do we need any more witnesses?" he said. "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, "Prophesy!" And the guards took him and beat him. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with that Nazarene Jesus," she said. But he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said, and went out into the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, "This fellow is one of them." Again he denied it. After a little while, those standing near to Peter, "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." He began to call down curses on himself, and he swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." Immediately the rooster crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken to him, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will disown me 3 times. And he broke down and wept. This ends the reading of God's word.
Thank you, Joyce. That's heavy in more ways than one. You know, I mean, that's a whole lot of words, but heavy ones. And here's the thing. If you've been with us as we have been working through Mark's gospel, then you know that Jesus, he's been talking about suffering for quite some time, right? He's been predicting it along the way. On several occasions, he said things like, the Son of Man must suffer. The Son of Man must die. He's been anticipating his own suffering. He's been literally walking in moving towards it, moving in closer geographical proximity to his pending suffering. But now, here in the remainder of chapter 14 and into chapter 15, to the end of chapter 15, actually, we see Jesus literally approaching his death here. And here in the Garden of Gethsemane, which is where we're going to be spending the majority of our time this morning, it's right here that he gets up close enough to that suffering to look it right in the face and to feel its hot breath on him. And it's right here, actually, not at the cross. It's here in this garden that the suffering truly begins for him. And we need to see that. In fact, some would argue that that here in the garden, his suffering is more acute than even at the cross itself, because this was, in a very literal and experiential way, the real moment of truth and impact for him. When it all basically, you could imagine it, when it all just swept over him. When the putrid smell of it all came wafting up into his face and into his nose. And because really, what we see here is this is the moment of decision for Jesus. This is when he really has to contend with a cross in a very real way. Now, I've not mentioned this until now, but for much of the church around the world, this is an important time of observation that we're in the midst of right at this very moment. It's a period of time within the calendar year that we refer to as Lent. A few weeks back, I sent an email out to those of you who are on the email list. You would have received a link to some resources so that you could observe Lent for yourself. But I think a good question to ask, especially as we approach this particular passage, is what is it? What is Lent? What are we talking about? Here's what Lent is about. It's about anticipation. And so it's very much like Advent in that way. And rather than hearing, when you hear the word Lent, rather than hearing this idea of somebody lending you something, the thing that you should hear in that word is the word lengthen. Actually, that's where this word Lent comes from. So it has to do with spring, when the days begin to lengthen and we anticipate the springing forth of all things good. growth, fruitfulness, right? Beauty, bounty, spring. And so in the same way, during the season of Lent, we eagerly anticipate the new life and the restoration and the beauty and the bounty that accompanies the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But along the way, we have to pass through the winter to get there. And this should not be a hard metaphor for any of us to kind of get behind. You're okay? Right? And many of us have a sore back to remind us of that very thing. I know I do. Consider it providence, I guess. As we remember and reflect during the season of Lent, we also embrace the fact that it is about suffering. Specifically, it's about the sufferings of Christ. And as a practice, it's about us identifying with the sufferings of Christ. This is why many folks during the season of Lent will fast from certain things that they would otherwise enjoy. And this is where we find ourselves right now. We're right in the thick of it as we come in to chapter 14. And so I think that if there are any questions that we can ask ourselves as we work through this passage, they would go something like this. How do we navigate our own suffering? Or let me put it to you a little bit more directly than that. How do you navigate your suffering? What do you do with your own distress? And more importantly, I think, and much more in the spirit of Lent, we need to ask the question, what do we do with the sufferings of Christ? How do we navigate them? How do you navigate them? How do you identify with them? How do they communicate to you about your own distress? How do the sufferings of Christ communicate to you about your own sufferings? Because they should. They must, actually. These are really, really important questions for anyone to ask who wants to be a serious follower of Jesus Christ. And by the way, there is no other follower of Jesus Christ. Right? To follow him is a serious thing. And we've seen this again and again. Jesus has communicated this to us abundantly throughout Mark's gospel, which is not to say by any means that we don't laugh. Here's the thing. If you're a true follower of Jesus Christ, then you ought to be dead serious about joy. We have great cause for hearty laughter, amen. Great cause for a good time and a light spirit, but mingled in with that joy is a sober look, a sober acknowledgement, an engagement, actually, with suffering, most specifically the sufferings of Christ. And so as we go, let's consider how we can identify with him here. This is a story. As we work through it, it'll become more clear. This is a story of abandon. What do I mean by that? Well, actually, I mean several things by that. What we see in this passage is the desertion of Jesus. He's abandoned by his closest friends and companions. They fail him. They forsake him. They deny him. And in the end, he's left to himself. We also see the distress of Jesus. And here we find him expressing himself in a spirit of abandon. In other words, he's letting it all hang out here. He's not holding anything back. And then lastly, we see the determination and the dependence of Jesus. And those two things go together. Okay? And here he altogether abandons himself into the care and into the hands of his trusted Father. So the desertion, the distress, and then lastly, the determination and dependence of Jesus. So first, the desertion. If you've been tracking with us along the way, then you know that during the early ministry of Jesus, he strategically approached 12 different individuals and told them to follow him. Right? These guys are what the scriptures refer to as the apostles. These men established the church, literally, and we have to remind ourselves that Jesus very mindfully, intentionally sought these guys out, handpicked them, and then for the last 3+ years of his life and his ministry, these guys, what were they to him? They were his constant companions for the last 3+ years. Now, obviously, when he told these guys to follow him, he meant it in a very literal way, okay? And so we have to imagine together all of them, day in, day out, eating and drinking together, traveling together on foot and by sea, gathering around fires, weathering storms together, facing sleepless nights together, at times going hungry, facing crowds, facing great reception by people, facing opposition, sleeping in close quarters, talking, learning, praying, struggling with hard situations, struggling with one another, right? And if you've ever done any kind of hard traveling with folks in close quarters for lengthy periods of time, anybody? I know a little bit about this. I feel like I can speak to this a little bit. The thing that happens when you spend that much time together in these sorts of ways is that, like it or not, you get close, okay? You grow to depend upon one another. You get to know one another's strengths. You get to know one another's weaknesses. You share stories. You share life. You laugh. You fight. And you either make up or you part ways. And these guys, they never parted ways, right? And so Jesus knew these men well, and he cared for them deeply, and he shared in friendship with them, no doubt. And as we'll see in the garden here in a moment, he's no stoic, okay? So he loved these men. He loved them. In fact, we see many circumstances that show us that Jesus had a special connection with a few men in particular that he would take with him to accompany him on special trips while he left others aside for in some capacity. And this is one of those occasions in the Garden of Gethsemane when that actually happens. But when we get to this part of the story, in what is Jesus is clearly is Jesus' greatest hour of need, when perhaps for the first time, maybe, he is really in special need of these guys, what happens? They all desert him. They all desert him. Every last one of them turns their back on him and runs off into the night. They abandon him. And this is going to be the last time that any of them are by his side on this side of the cross. Last time that'll happen. Now, anybody even remotely paying attention in the general public, we all are familiar with the betrayal of Judas, right? The infamous kiss of death. All you have to do is hear that name. All you have to do is hear the name Judas, and anyone immediately thinks of a traitor, right? So, friendly tip for everybody, okay? Don't name your child Judas. Okay? I would avoid that if you could. That one's free, as in the house. Okay, and then the same thing is true of Peter. I mean, maybe to a lesser extent, but many know of his impassioned promises to stand by Jesus no matter what, or to die trying, right? And then how he went on to deny him three times, and then in that emphatically swear, "I've never met this man." Never met him. We're familiar with that. But what about the others? What about the others? Our familiarity with the two that I just mentioned can really overshadow these guys. And we can forget about them. But look back at verses 30 and 31, which would be in your call to worship. It's the last thing that we read together in the call to worship. 30 and 31, it says, "Truly I tell you," Jesus answered, he's talking to Peter here, "today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times." But Peter insisted emphatically, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And then what does it say? "And all the others said the same." What he said, us too. Never. We're all in this, all of us. "And all the others said the same." And then we come down to verse 50. Just as Jesus is addressing this armed posse who are about to take hold of him, and we read this. "Then everyone deserted him and fled." And then right after that, we get this very unique entry in verse 51 where it says, "A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garment behind." And the first time you read this, it may seem a bit comical, and it may still seem a bit comical. But I think that there is something really significant about the inclusion of this that is worth noticing. A lot of people have concluded that this is Mark, who, is the one who is writing this narrative. You might want to leave your name off of this kind of event. So if it was Mark, it might make sense that he kept his name anonymous. But the fact is we don't know. We don't know who this is. They're anonymous, just like a nameless individual, a follower of Christ, struggling and fleeing into the night with no covering. Talk about desperate. And it really captures the tone and the reality of this situation that's going on here. And as one author put it, and very insightfully, I think, quote, "Mark's leaving him unidentified appears to be intentional and purposeful. The young man represents all who flew in desperation when mayhem broke out at the arrest of Jesus. This particular story speaks for all present. His lack of identity also invites readers to examine their own readiness to abandon Jesus. So, you know, this isn't so much about us identifying with Jesus here as it is about us identifying with the apostles. In other words, think about this. If 12 individuals who were intimately acquainted with Jesus and were in company with him for over 3 years, through thick and through thin, his closest companions, his friends, if they were convinced that surely, when it really comes down to it, surely we'll stand by him and even die with him, surely. And yet when the time actually came, they all turned tail and ran. If these guys, why not us, right? All chosen, handpicked, all of them fled. Does this, when you look at this, is this, does it seem like something that's beneath you to do that? And the thing is, if you want to get connected with the sufferings of Christ, you can't. You can't afford to see this as something that is beneath you. Apart from God's Spirit, you can't see this as beneath you. We have to see this as, we have to see ourselves as having far more in common with this man running naked into the night than we might like to think. Right? And remember this. Here's something to consider. Jesus called it. He predicted this. He knew this was going to happen. He knew that he would be abandoned in the end. So it was no surprise to him in any way. And along the lines of prediction, because I don't know if you noticed this through all the reading that we did, it's hard to pick up on particulars, but Mark cites at least 11 predictions made by Jesus in chapter 14 alone, just in chapter 14. And unlike the previous chapter, chapter 13, most of these predictions are very imminent. They're very close at hand, right around the corner. And here's the thing, if you're going to make predictions, you might want to make predictions that can be verified after you're dead, okay? If you're going to do that sort of thing. But Jesus doesn't. Jesus is like, go into the city and a guy with a water jar is going to be right there. That's the guy you're looking for. Head in. He says, here's what's going to happen. Later on this evening, you're going to deny me 3 times. And just after the third time, a rooster's going to crow twice for the second time. And so these are all very highly specific pinpoint predictions. And they're like right around the corner. And they all of them have one thing in common, which is what? Him. They all have him in common. They all have to do with the suffering that awaits Jesus. And so with all of these predictions and this foresight, we get what you could say is just a really very candid look at the divinity of Christ. This passage is like smacking with his deity. But when you come into the Garden of Gethsemane, we suddenly see this very different side of Jesus, a total contrast from what I just expressed. Look back at verse 33 on page 6. It says, he took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, he said to them. Stay here and keep watch. Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup away. Take this cup from me. As we've gone along, we've talked about how Mark's gospel is very concise, how it's very fast-paced, how it has many literary devices, the Mark and sandwiches, right, that Kevin was going on about last week. And there's many other things that you could talk about that distinguish Mark's unique signature in this book. But one that often comes up and that maybe we have not touched upon yet is how Mark uniquely gives us insight into the humanity and into the emotional life of Jesus. And nowhere is it more prominent than right here. You can't look back through Mark's gospel. If you look back through Mark's gospel, you're not going to find anything like this that we see in the garden. Nothing like it. Jesus takes his closest companions with him, and the moment he enters the garden, he abandons composure. He abandons composure. He holds nothing back. This is the distress of Jesus, by the way, which I probably should have titled The Desperation of Jesus, because that's exactly what he is here. He's desperate. He tells these three friends that he is so overwhelmed that he feels like he might just drop dead on the spot. And then he walks off to pray, and he immediately collapses into a heap on the ground and does something that really ought to shock us if we're paying attention. What does he do? He asks for a way out. I want out. I want out of this. I want to hang it up. This is too much. Is there a way out? Think about this. He prays and asks to be removed from the central purpose for which he came. That's what he's asking. And it may sound like an odd thing to say at this point, but we can stand to learn something from this. Why? Because it is a fearless prayer. It is a fearless prayer that is dripping with childlike trust, which is the very thing that he has been asking of us in the previous chapters, right? He's doing it. He's demonstrating it. He's showing it to us. The very thing that he's been encouraging all along. You only say these kinds of things to who? You only say these kinds of things? You only just rattle off and abandon yourself in these kinds of ways with those who you truly, utterly trust? As all the horror and fear is pressing in on him, he gives it a voice, and he directs that voice to his trusted father in a state of utter abandonment. Abba, he says. This is unbearable. Help. And in case you don't know, Abba is a child's term of endearment. It means Papa. Papa. Daddy. And by the way, this is the one and only time that this word is used in Mark's gospel. Only time it's used. It's not used in the daylight, right? It's not packed into a parable. It's not the subject of a teaching. It's not said with a waking soul around. It's the desperate prayer of Jesus in the dark of night, the darkest night of his life. Do you ever pray like this? Does your desperation cause you to fall on your face before God and appeal to him as a child would to their father? Or is it beneath you to do that? Because it wasn't beneath him to do that. Some of you may be thinking, yeah, but you know what? Come, hold up, Doug. Like, you know, this is the very thing that is wrong with the world, is this kind of thing right here. Everybody's trying to run from their troubles. You know, we need a little bit less collapsing on the ground and crying out for daddy and just a little more grit. I have a problem with this. Whatever happened to John Wayne, you know? Whatever happened to, you know, like a stiff upper lip in you know, just going out in a blaze. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and that sort of thing. Like, whatever happened to that? In his commentary on Mark's gospel, James R. Edwards, he raises a very similar question, which is helpful to navigate this thought. And this actually carries us straight into our last point, which is the determination and dependence of Jesus. But here's what Edwards says. He says, why, we may ask, is Jesus so assailed by the prospect of his death? Surely we all know individuals who face the prospect of their deaths with greater composure and courage than does Jesus. Did not Socrates greet death as a friend and liberator to a better life? Did not the Stoics preach serene resignation to fate? Why does Jesus, who has foreseen his death and marched resolutely to Jerusalem to meet it, now quail before it? That's an interesting question to think about, right? Why have so many others, even who followed after him, his followers, died better than this? To get a bit of a clue into the answer to this question, we just need to look into the text. Look back at verse 33. He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. Commentators point out that this word, distressed, could very easily be translated as alarmed, shocked. And deeply troubled could be translated as horrified. Alarmed and horrified. But, you know, wait a minute. So for someone who's been predicting these things in such detail for so long now, does it not seem kind of strange? Isn't it kind of strange that he would be alarmed or horrified by the prospect of his own death at this point? Which can only mean that something much more significant is at play here. What's going on? And the real clue to this, the way into this, is in verse 36, because that word cup, which may not seem too profound to our ears, to a Jewish person's ears, that meant something. It spoke of the judgment and the wrath of God. Throughout the Old Testament, again and again, this word cup is used as a symbol to represent the judgment and the wrath of God. Divine justice towards human injustice. And so when Jesus turned the corner and headed into this garden, the thing that he saw when he came around the bend that shocked and horrified him was this cup waiting for him. Because it's been poured for him, right? The righteous anger over sin, the righteous anger of the sin of all humanity, is now reserved for him, and it leaves him in a state of deathly horror. The same guy, Edwards, goes on to say this: Jesus necessarily experiences an abandonment and darkness of cosmic proportions. The worst prospect of becoming the sin bearer for humanity is that it spells complete alienation from God, an alienation that will shortly echo above the desolate landscape of Calvary. My God, why have you forsaken me? And if we do have any John Wayne fans in the crowd, please notice something. And by the way, I'm not dissing John Wayne. You know, I like the Duke as much as the next guy. But hear this, though. Notice this. Jesus has desperately expressed the fears and the troubles that are bearing down on him, but he does not run from them. He doesn't bow down to them and serve them. He doesn't allow them to dictate the way forward. He simply gives voice to them. In fact, he says, I would like nothing more than to turn tail and run off into the dark right now, and to put as much distance as I possibly can between me and that cup. Everything inside of me is screaming escape right now. But I won't. I won't move. If there is a way out of this, Abba, it will have to come by your hand and by your will. And if that relief doesn't come, if it doesn't come, then let come what will, because I would rather entrust myself into the worst of troubles with you than to peace without you. And so I am putting myself into your trusted hands. I'm abandoning myself and my fears. I'm defying them, actually. I'm defying them into your hands. Have you ever prayed like that? That's a gritty prayer. That's a gritty prayer. But it begins with desperation. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, famed Lutheran pastor from Germany, who he was hung for his faith as an anti-Nazi dissident, he did a wonderful job of expressing this relationship between desperation and grit. And you can find this in your time of reflection if you want to read on with me, actually. He said this: when a man really gives up trying to make something out of himself, a saint or a converted sinner or a churchman, a so-called clerical somebody, and throws himself into the arms of God, then he wakes up with Christ in Gethsemane. That is faith. That is metanoia. And it is thus that he becomes a man and a Christian. By the way, what is metanoia? It means spiritual transformation. It means true conversion. In other words, this is how you really grow up and get some grit, is what he's essentially saying. Not by being a self-made individual, not with self-sustaining strength, but by waking up with Christ in Gethsemane, recognizing the true state of your desperation for the Father, and then throwing yourself into his arms. That'll make a man out of you, is what he's saying. He says, that'll make a man out of you. That'll make a Christian out of you. So, you know, put that in your pipe and smoke it, John Wayne. In closing, let's ask this. Let's get practical for a moment. How do we identify with the sufferings of Christ, and how do they communicate to us in our own distress and sufferings? Because here's the thing, you know, maybe you feel like people are falling asleep on you in your worst moments in your life. What do you do when the people that you love fail you, when you feel abandoned by them? What do you do? Or maybe you feel like a deserter. Maybe you feel like Peter. Maybe you feel like a failure. Or maybe you feel like you're two steps away from collapsing on the ground, and you're begging God for another way forward in the situation that you find yourself in. Maybe you feel like God has abandoned you altogether. What do you do? As I've been working through this passage, I've been thinking about this. I've been reminded of a time in my own life when I felt like God had somehow abandoned me because of some truly hard things that I was going through. And feeling as though he abandoned me, what it really did in me is it drove me away from him rather than pulling me in closer to him. That's what it did. And it took a long time for me to see what this passage, I think, tells us so plainly. So what will it take for us to entrust these sorts of painfully difficult things into his hands rather than running? What is it going to take? What will make us say, Abba, Papa, I don't think I can bear this. Help. When our circumstances leave us feeling as though we've been abandoned by God, what will move in and assure us that that surely isn't the case? And it's the essence of the gospel that we find here in Gethsemane. Think about this, that though friendless, deserted by his dearest companions in deep distress, in total horror, Jesus sees the cup of God's judgment in front of him. He sees a way of escape on every side. He could have ran in any direction. His friends were asleep, no soldiers around, it's dark. But he stays. He looks the cop right in the face, he feels its hot breath, he remains. He entrusts himself to his loving Father, and he commits himself in love to us, and he knowingly points his nose towards the cross at this point. This is the one who asks us to trust him in our distress. This is the one that asks us to trust him in our sufferings. He experienced the abandonment of God so that we would never have to experience the abandonment of God. And so that we never have to feel as though he has abandoned us. I love this. And last thing here, Charles Spurgeon, old English pastor, he's comparing the Garden of Eden and the Garden of Gethsemane. He's comparing and contrasting. And poetically, he says this: see yonder another king's garden, which the king waters with his bloody sweat, Gethsemane, whose bitter herbs are sweeter far to renewed souls than even Eden's luscious fruits. He's saying there's treasure here, guys. There's treasure in the Garden of Gethsemane. This is a garden for us to return to again and again, to recognize God's commitment, his radical commitment to us, that he endured this, that he underwent this for us. Father, we commit ourselves to you. God, would you help us to entrust ourselves to you with such abandon as Jesus did. And we thank you for him. In Jesus' name we do pray. Amen.